So I'm talking to Laura Bex Lempert about her book, Woman Doing Life, Gender Punishment and the Struggle for Identity. And that's doing life in prison. Quite an intense topic. Laura, can you give us some of your background and how you came to this project?
I'm Professor Emerita from the University of Michigan, Dearborn. I'm a sociologist. My initial research was on violence against women, specifically domestic violence or intimate interpersonal violence. Shortly after I moved to Michigan, a friend of mine, a Quaker, Isabel Yingling, was the sponsor of Chapter 1014 of the National Lifers of America at what was then Scott Correctional Facility.
Okay.
And she asked me to come in and speak to the women because we know well over 85% of women in prison have been in abusive relationships of
85%.
Some sort.
I was curious about that, how much of a tie-in there is. I knew it was big.
Oh, yeah, it's well over that. And it's violence in their families of origin, sexual violence, violence in intimate partner relationships. Not everybody has all of them, but many women have some of them. There's a woman in the book who says, and I'm paraphrasing here, but she said, you know, my mother prepared me for my abuser and my abuser prepared me for prison.
Yeah.
So that there is this component of violation prior to offending. And so I went in and met the women, and the story that the women tell is that then Laura fell in love with us. And I leave that story and sort of embrace it myself because I have come to love many of these women and their successors in the 20 years I spent in interaction with them.
Yeah.
But what that really meant was that Isabel had asked me to co-sponsor the lifers with her because women inside, and men as well, cannot meet independently in groups because it's a security risk.
Right.
The prison officials always think they're planning insurrection or escape or something. So they need outside facilitators. And because Isabel was the only sponsor, she couldn't ever go away. She couldn't go away on a weekend because if that meant if she was gone, then the group couldn't meet.
Mm.
And so she asked me to co-sponsor that group with her, and I started doing that. And out of that grew the college classes that we offer and continue to offer since my retirement at the facility. And then before my retirement, my deciding these women's voices needed to be heard.
Yeah.
And so we have this book.
Well, I'm glad because as you write about in the book, this is an invisible population. And I suppose some of that is human nature. People just don't want to think about it. And there are those who I think if nothing like this has touched their lives in any way, oh, lock them up and throw away the key. But to give us some scale, and I'm hoping that most people by now know that the United States is actually, it may be land of the free, but it's also land of the biggest prisons in the world. Is that still correct?
Yes, yes. We incarcerate more people than any other nation in the world. And that includes Russia during the Gulag. That includes China. We incarcerate more of our population than any other people in the world.
Laura, why is that?
Oh, there are so many reasons. Partly it's tough on crime. You know, do the crime, do the time. Partly it has been the expansion of felony incarcerations over what used to be misdemeanor, what's called widening the net, transferring people from juvenile to adult in prosecutorial decision-making.
Which I find alarming. Science has said that their brains aren't really developed until 21 or so.
Exactly, exactly. But we incarcerate children as young as 14 on life sentences. And what we found since the Supreme Court decision that says you can't mandatorily or automatically incarcerate juveniles for life, is that some states have gone to sentencing juveniles to 80 to 90 year sentences, which is essentially a life sentence.
And tough on crime obviously isn't working because they're just getting bigger and bigger. What is it that we're doing wrong? And I'm going to guess it's lack of rehabilitation. Is it lack of society's awareness that rehabilitation works better? Because the recidivism rate is what, 70, 75, 80%?
For some crimes, it definitely is that. And if you had a business that had that high a failure rate, you'd close it down.
Absolutely. Or you'd rethink
it. The prison system, they just throw money at it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are a lot of solutions. One is, of course, starting at the cause of the problem, which is societal inequality, poor schooling, dysfunctional neighborhoods, the kinds of situations where we see, you know, it was yet another officer got off this week after shooting another black man.
Yeah.
Those sort of inequalities manifest themselves in communities that then manifest themselves in the ways that people need to earn the money to support their families, the hustles, so that a lot of people are in prison on drug charges. These are not the kingpins. These are people at the lower end, by and large, of the drug distribution system. So if you have a woman who is a single parent who's selling, nickel bags of coke on the street, she's going to have to sell a lot of those to make enough money to support her family. And so she is, of course, going to come to the attention of the police.
Yeah.
If you have a guy who's making a $10,000 drop in a wealthy neighborhood, he goes in once a month and nobody even knows he's there.
Yeah.
So he escapes surveillance. So a lot of what has to happen before we get into the system. And then once people are in the system, they can't buy out because they've got to wait for public defenders who are poorly invested in. Many of them are great lawyers, but they don't have the kind of investment that prosecutors have for investigations. They have high caseloads. So over 95% of people who are arrested plead out. They don't go to court.
Yeah.
They don't get trials because it's just too costly and it would block up the system. And if somebody chooses to go to court, then prosecutors overcharge them. So they charge them with five or six charges on the same crime, so they can catch them on at least one or two.
So talk to us about how this affects the inmate, sure, and that's, you know, in great part what your book is about, but also families, and with women, children really take a hit. If you could address that a little bit more.
Sure. And let me say, even before that, that many of us do not use terms like inmate or prisoner or felon because there's so much baggage that comes with that label that nowhere in the book are we incarcerated women referred to with those terms. They're called life-serving women or life-sentenced women because it's really important to remember who they are as people. And
good
once
point.
You
yeah.
put a label on them, you lose who they are.
Good point.
So let me then move on to the question you asked me, which is about children. Frequently, women in stressed communities, and many of the women inside come from stressed communities, they are the social glue that holds the community together. And when they are incarcerated for life, their children get bounced. So only 11% of fathers of the children nationwide take over the care and primary responsibility of those children. Some are sent to foster care, and here's the problem with foster care. In 1994, Bill Clinton signed the Families and Adoption Act, and the intent of that was to get children out of foster care and into adoptive families.
Mm-hmm.
The unintended consequence of that is that it severs parental ties of mothers to their children if they have long-term sentences, because you have to have had frequent and continuous contact over a 15-month period. And if your child's in foster care parents are not required under any rules to bring those children to see you in prison.
Yeah, and you address that in the book, that it costs money, it costs time, and, you know, these people would have to have a real interest in traveling sometimes maybe hours and hours for visitation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's hard for families to do.
Yeah.
So children who get placed in foster care are often then, their rights to their families are terminated. Throwing the kids then into the foster care system permanently, or severing them from, certainly from their mothers, but often from their siblings as well, because people don't generally adopt the whole family.
Right.
Other resources for kids are that they go to the grandmother, or they go to a family member in the community or in the family where the woman was stressed and offending.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids have really, really difficult times, both having your mother in prison, the social stigma that goes with that. So families of women who are incarcerated for life do time with those women.
Yeah.
Both in terms of trying to keep contact, trying to maintain some sort of semblance of support for the kids. Those kids often do poorly in school, often offend themselves, so that it creates what is really a negative cycle in the lives of these children.
What happens to identity behind the bars? You made a good point here earlier about not referring to these women as inmates, because that can erase identity.
Well, it's like any what sociologists call total institutions, where you no longer become who you are. You become who the institution wants you to be. And prisons are predicated on a male model. So women come in, women inside, incarcerated women do not wear skirts. That is not available to them. They wear the same uniforms that men wear. Their numbers are screened across the shoulders of their shirts and down the legs of their pants. They become numbers, and they are expected to behave. You know, the only way you can keep prison order is to treat people collectively and not individually. So everybody has to be on board with the way things operate. And prisons are very scheduled institutions. And so for a good part of what occurs once you are sentenced, you are placed into what's called closed custody, where you're on lockdown 23 hours a day. And during that period, you learn the protocols of the prison. You learn the expectations of the prisoners, of the prison, for your behavior. And whoever you were on the outside is irrelevant, because you have no power in prison. You are a prisoner. And you learn to be a prisoner in prison.
Laura, we've talked here about numbers and statistics. I would love for you to share some of the stories of 72 women, some that really stick with you, haunt you maybe, and give them a face. Bring them alive for us here.
You know, I think for everybody who either works in prisons or volunteers in prisons or is part of the prison abolition movement, there are particular stories that grab us, that are stories that in sort of bumper sticker form tell you what this is all about. And for me, one of those stories is a story that occurred with the dean of my college when we had a reception at the end of, I think it was the first year of the college classes that we offered inside the facility. And at that time, we were allowed to hold a reception, you know, little completion ceremony party at the end of the meeting. And so what I insisted on was bringing in fruits that the women don't usually get. So we had piles of strawberries and chocolate and stuff like that. And a woman was sitting with me and with the dean, and she had this huge plate full of strawberries. And she looked at my dean and said, "I haven't had a strawberry since my 13th birthday."
Wow.
And the woman was in her 40s.
Comes down to the simple pleasures, the details of life, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I mean, you, of course, intellectually understand, yes, you're locked up, you can't go to the mall, you can't do this, you can't do that. And those kinds of things are understood by all of us. But as you say, the simple pleasures, the small freedoms that we have that are not available to them. Another is, of course, women who talk about their wombs being on lockdown because they were incarcerated before they had a chance to have children, and they're incarcerated beyond their childbearing years.
Mm.
And so they can never have children. And that's experienced, of course, as a terrible loss to those women who wanted to have children.
Yeah.
So there are over and over those kinds of losses. But I also want to say in drawing pictures of the women inside that they are among the finest group of women I've ever met. And people are always stunned when I say that because the characterization of women inside is that they're monstrous in some ways. And some are. Okay, I'm not modifying some are. I think very few, but some are.
Mm-hmm.
But others are, this is, for many of them, their only violation. They didn't even have parking tickets. And they're forced to create a life inside of dignity and worth in a context that denies them dignity and worth at every instance, and in a national narrative that does the same. But the way they treat each other and the way they support each other, and they do more with less than many people on the outside in terms of generosity, compassion, kindness, and I'm always very moved by that.
So what can we do, Laura? What kind of social reform should we fight for? How do we make the invisible visible?
Well, I think we've got to look at who we're electing. We have to make incarceration a number one issue for our elected officials. So when they send you those forms and say, what's most important to you, and they give you these whole lists and incarceration's not on it, we need to add it. When we're electing people to public office, we need to ask them what their position is on incarceration, on diversion, on restorative justice. Where do they position themselves? Is it, if they're do the crime, do the time people, they are going for simplistic answers, and they're not people that we ought to be supporting.
Good points. Anything you'd like to add as we wind this up, something that I haven't asked?
I think I would really like your listeners to think about, in a more complicated fashion, the way that the media constructs people who commit crime, and to think more about punishment, the punishment they've experienced themselves in their own lives, and how effective it was, and whether or not it was effective. And then think about whether what we want to do is spend our time punishing people, or whether what we want to do is prepare people for a return to the community. Because 95% of the people in prison come out. And I would prefer people to come out better than worse, especially if they're going to be living in my neighborhood.
So rehabilitation, we need to bring those programs back. I think we've lost a lot of them, haven't we?
Yes, we have. And we need to have higher education in prison, because every single study demonstrates that for every bit of higher education people get while they are inside, there is a corresponding reduction in recidivism.
Yeah.
So that, of course, people who are able to earn master's degrees inside have a 2 to 3% recidivism rate. But even people who only take one or two classes begin to see themselves as different than they were when they went in. And that is critically important.
Education is key. That's something that we need to invest in, and we get a lot back when we invest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've known that for years. You know, if you invest in Head Start, you have better outcomes in elementary and high school. I mean, education is the way to improve the society.
And I imagine a lot of these women, since they're coming out of violent situations more times than not, domestic violence, that kind of a thing, self-esteem is at the bottom. And education, I would think, gives you, empowers you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That many of the people inside, men and women, never thought of themselves as people who could go to college. That was not on their screen for their futures because they didn't have people like that. That isn't what happened in their communities. Many of them dropped out of school or were in schools that were so low performing that they were in some ways a waste of time. And then they take a college class and start to understand, hey, I am smart. I can do this. It is empowering.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. I could probably talk to you for hours around this topic. It's fascinating.
Well, thank you very much for your interest in life-serving women.